Welcome to Undisputed, a Norton Rose Fulbright podcast. I'm Ted Brook.
And I'm Erin Brown.
We're excited to be hosting this special mini-series to unpack the findings of our firm's annual litigation trends report. For 19 years, our firm's research has tracked changes and trends defining the litigation landscape, from dispute types and exposure to litigation preparedness and in-house legal staffing, by surveying legal professionals at organizations of all sizes across key commercial sectors in Canada and the U.S.
In Undisputed, we'll explore the emerging trends and insights concerning the litigation challenges industry leaders are facing in 2024. Hope you enjoy. Welcome to the podcast. We're so happy to have you today. So today we'll be speaking with John Castle, who is a partner in our Calgary office, and Imran Ahmed, who is a partner in our Toronto and Montreal offices. John and Imran are the co-heads of Information Governance, Privacy, and Cybersecurity at Norton Rose Fulbright, and Imran is the head of technology. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I guess with both of you here, we have one head of national information governance, privacy, and cybersecurity, right? The two of you together, it's like Transformers. You come together and create this ultimate head of the team.
Although John is the vast majority of that. So he's the brain behind the whole practice. I'm a small minority shareholder.
Oh, you're too modest.
Power in numbers. Yeah, absolutely. We're here multiplied in strength.
And we need you to be, because we're talking about what I think is probably the highlight of the litigation trends survey. It's clear from the very first page that what's concerning in-house counsel in Canada and the US the most is an uptick in litigation relating to cybersecurity, data governance, information security.
Before we get into too much, your first intro line has raised my first question. So we hear a lot on cybersecurity, cyber breaches, data privacy, data protection, AI, generative AI. Can you give us a quick sort of overview, lay of the land? What does each of those concepts really mean? And how do those things relate to each other and overlap or not overlap?
It's a lot to unpack. When we're talking to our clients, really it comes down to digital risk. Everybody has a digital footprint these days. Gone are the days, although it does happen once in a while, clients are going to be entirely paper-based. Everything is digital these days. Just by way of background for the audience, like I started out as a tech lawyer. I was not doing cybersecurity. I was not doing AI. I was not doing privacy either. But over the last 20 years or so, those areas have evolved and grown significantly. So how has it grown exactly? Tech always changes. There's always something new coming up. A few years ago, it was blockchain. There was the metaverse. And now we're talking a lot about AI. But cyber is unique. I think it stands on its own because it is one of those major risks that companies are facing that have a reputational, operational, financial, and for us lawyers, legal and regulatory impact. And that can literally impact the client's operations short-term, but longer-term goodwill of the reputation as well. It's our job, either as breach coach, to guide them and navigate and be their trusted advisor through that very difficult situation. Or in a more ideal scenario, if you have not had a breach, talking to the board, talking to leadership, and making sure that they understand how they can mitigate that risk on the front end. So cyber is pretty unique. As an adjacent to that, but slightly differently, we often have to advise on privacy-related issues because they have employee information and consumer information and so on. And that's where it becomes really tricky because the enforcement environment of privacy, not just here in Canada and provincially, but globally as well, has increased significantly. I know we'll get into the legislative developments because it's really a game changer from a Canadian perspective. But on AI, I'll just share the story with the audience. I think it's really worthwhile. In the last 12 to 14 months, there's been this storyline. Generative AI has been around for a while. Like people know about it. AI has been there for decades. But and there's been research that's been going on over time. But in November of 2022, you had ChatGPT launch. Very few people even tracked it. And there was a first phase where everybody was super excited. It was going to change and revolutionize how we do things. And to a large extent, that was a lot of hype, but also a lot of reality to it too. And then in the spring of last year, almost to the year, you had a few leading seminal pioneers in AI research who came out and said, hold on a second, this could turn out to be like the Terminator and Skynet, and the singularity will come out and destroy humanity. We need to put a pause on how quickly this is developing. And a lot of people freaked out. The average consumer or individual who's looking at AI is like, whoa, where are we going with this? And that prompted this third phase we're at right now, which is regulatory development. Let's build a box around this. Is there a framework? So we'll get into all of these things, but they're all interconnected because the lifeline in all of this is the data part. Data in cybersecurity, data in privacy, or data in the AI component.
Yeah. And so when you say that, Imran, it's really interesting. And something I want to circle back on is what you said, AI is the real deal. And I want to talk to you a little bit about that. So the way you have cybersecurity, you have data protection, you have privacy, and AI sort of is an element of all three. It amplifies some of the concerns and risks in each of those areas. Or do you see it as a standalone area now that clients are thinking about?
Ted, you know, I think it connects all of those various areas. AI will touch on privacy in terms of how it impacts personal information. Is AI using individuals' personal information to make automated decisions, as an example? Information governance often refers to, and data refers to data more than personal information, all types of data. Do those same sorts of questions apply to commercial data, intellectual property? And then, of course, it impacts cybersecurity as well. An example that Imran and myself see is the attacks are more devastating now. AI is now being used by threat actor groups to cause more damaging incidents and attacks. The phishing emails are more convincing.
This reminds me, when I was first started at Norton Rose, I got a phishing email that seemed to come from, I think it was Andrea Brewer, who is in corporate department, not part of the team that I worked on, but she asked me if I could run a quick errand for her. And it was one of those like really rudimentary phishing attacks where they ask you to do something. You say, yeah, sure, I can do that. And then it's okay, can you run to the store and buy me like $100 gift cards? Right. And then it's, whoa, that sounds odd. I called her. I said, what's going on? She says, I don't know what you're talking about. But I feel like now with AI being able to replicate people's voices, that sort of first defense against a targeted phishing scheme could.
Ted, it's not,
things get more complicated.
It's not hypothetical what you're saying. It's happening already. If listeners are interested, they can go on the Quebec Securities Exchange Commission, the AMF, Autorité des marchés financiers website, and they actually put a bulletin out on the use of deepfakes. And a deepfake could be a picture or it could be somebody's voice. But essentially what it is, it captures your imprint. And the interesting part about generative AI is when you're talking, for example, Ted, like right now, there's a spectrum in which your voice operates. It's a very unique digital footprint that you have. What generative AI does, it tries to take a little bit of that and create a whole conversation, but your imprint can be a bit larger at that point. But to the average listener, you can't tell the difference. Remember a few months ago, you heard, oh, there's a new song that generative AI made that is in Drake's voice. What happens is, you know, what the AMF reported, and there's others as well. There's reports about companies having diverted $2.5 million despite having put a lot of effort to identify all the protocol that you described. Pick up the phone, call someone and figure things out. They will send that phishing email, which we're all accustomed to. It will be a bit more sophisticated than the Nigerian Prince type of email. And then once you look at it, you go, well, I know what the protocol is. I need to validate if this makes sense or not. Let me pick up the phone. But what they'll say is in the email, I'm traveling, I'll call you. And they'll call after hours when they know the person's not going to pick it up. And then they leave a message saying, hey, it's Jane Doe or John Doe authorizing the transaction of the email that was just sent to you a few hours. They'll give you the timestamp and the description. So it looks really legit. And the average controller, CFO, or the financial person will say, well, look, I got the authorization. I've got a written that's coming from a legitimately looking email. I've done what I had to do. And lo and behold, they're out of money in that situation. So this is happening now.
Okay, so this has given us, I think, a really good sense of what's going on in this complicated, evolving area. But let's bring it back to disputes for a minute. 40% of organizations surveyed in the Litigation Trends survey saw their cybersecurity dispute exposure grow in 2023 and are predicting that cybersecurity is going to be a huge factor moving forward into 2024. So bringing it back to sort of the legal landscape and the disputes that companies are facing as a result of these things, John, can you give us some examples of the types of disputes that you're seeing in the sort of cybersecurity data privacy sector?
Yeah. Unfortunately, due to the nature of cyber incidents, there's disputes, and that's the arising out of breaches. And that's really the overarching goal of a lot of our clients, is to avoid disputes and mitigate risk. That's the number one goal coming out of incidents. So some of the major disputes that come out of data breaches, cybersecurity issues, are potentially class action risk, obviously more prevalent in the United States than in Canada. But as an example, where an organization has had a large-scale data breach that's resulted in the compromise of a lot of data, personal information, or otherwise, plaintiff class members can band together and commence a claim against the organization. The basis for that may be on various different torts, negligence, or there's new emerging torts in Canada, the intrusion upon seclusion torts. So it'll be based on some legal basis, really with the basis that you have breached my personal information and I've suffered damages. That's always top of mind of clients as the most threatening and damaging type of dispute. There was a very important trilogy of cases released in Ontario in this past summer that really reframed and narrowed the opportunity for successful class action plaintiff lawsuits arising out of a data breach. So those were really important cases, really narrowed the application of this new tort of intrusion upon seclusion, when that can be used. And then importantly, reaffirmed that plaintiffs or individuals who have had their data breached really have to suffer damage.
With this sort of data compromising types of litigation, and I can see how that is top of mind for companies, but I was wondering if there, even if avenues for class actions in that space in Ontario is narrowing, are there other types of lawsuits that are becoming maybe more common, whether in the US or Canada? I'm thinking like failure to disclose a breach or representations made regarding certain protections or infrastructure that was in place that perhaps become litigated in the securities markets.
Great question. And you've hit on an emerging trend, particularly in Canada. Cyber to date has really been folded as part of ESG disclosure reporting and financial statements. So companies are increasingly having to disclose their cybersecurity risks and how they mitigate them and set that out in their public disclosures. We haven't yet seen that translated into lawsuits in Canada for misrepresenting your security posture in your financial statements or otherwise, but it's likely on the horizon. We're watching it very closely, whether there's representative actions. So I think that's an emerging trend, something we're watching very closely, whether that turns into derivative actions or those types of disputes. I would suggest that's on the horizon. That's the next big type of cybersecurity-related dispute that we're waiting to see if it manifests itself in Canada.
But I will say this much on the trend study. I know where most of the folks are coming from. In the last 18 months, the B2B relationship is key. So if you're a company, AcmeCo, and downstream you've got 5 or 6 different vendors, and one of those vendors is processing your data, and they experience a breach that impacts your data. From a privacy standpoint, if we're talking about personal information, you have liability there. But that third-party vendor may not share as much information or at the cadence or with the granularity that you want. And that's where we see a lot of challenges. So beyond the privacy litigation, privacy regulatory, or other types of actions, the B2B one, because there's a business relationship. It's not just pure legal contractual dispute here. There's a business relationship that, generally speaking, parties want to salvage somehow, but they also need to get comfort on, can we continue doing business with you? And are you going to make us whole as a result of the breach you suffered with our data? And that's where we see a lot of difficulties, because each client has a different threshold. Each client has a different level of sophistication when it comes to cybersecurity. And sometimes it can be very challenging to manage those expectations.
I'm really glad you brought that up, Imran. It struck me that the third-party vendors are a bit of a boogeyman in the report. Like there's a quote from a telecom AGC who says, this is where the real cyber risks are for us, because we use a vendor who uses a vendor who uses some other vendor, and eventually someone on down the chain isn't as sophisticated as us or the people in our immediate sort of circle. And So what do you do if you're an enterprise who's relying on outside vendors to store, transfer, analyze data to protect yourself and your customers all the way down the line?
Answer your question, Ted. It's really screen the risk and at the outset and manage the risk throughout the relationship. And what I mean by that is we help a lot of our clients set up a vendor onboarding process. When you're onboarding a vendor who would have access to all of your data or your customer data, as an example, that is a lot of risk, a significant amount of risk to you and your customers. Are you screening that particular vendor for their cybersecurity safeguards at the outset? When we highly recommend that they do that, set up detailed questionnaires, and that you're really doing your due diligence on that vendor before you enter into any type of agreement with them. Depending on, you get a score, you'll screen your vendor on the risk and how much data they have. Really, in a lot of cases, it flows back to the contract. Depending on the risk that you've assessed, does your contract adequately reflect the risk? Do you have contractual levers that you've built into your contracts with those vendors that allow you to, you know, impose certain security safeguards on them? In the event of a breach, what happens? So it's really a full risk matrix when looking at your vendors. But it's a big issue. A lot of our clients have very robust cybersecurity programs, but they also recognize where they have a bit of a blind spot or it can be difficult to manage is third-party vendors. We're getting notices from our third-party vendors multiple times a week that they've had an incident. They're difficult to manage. How can we manage this risk? It's not an easy answer.
It seems to me from what you're saying, John, that one of the main ways to minimize risk in this space is to be proactive and try to stay ahead of the curve and have good policies and procedures in place and have people like you and Imran ready to call up if need be. Is that a fair assessment of sort of how to manage risks?
That's absolutely right. We always recommend being proactive. There's a number of things that organizations can do, again, to get ahead of those risks and be prepared.
John, you're right on point there. And Aaron, look, proactive preparation, what does that mean? It's not just a policy, or it's not just a protocol, or it's not just a list that you want to have or a checklist. You want to actually test it. The protocols and the plans are great. That's the baseline. But testing them out, stress testing them year over year, identifying the gaps, improving them, it's constant updating their protocols and their policies.
Yeah, staying ahead and the sort of expectation now is a customized plan. Like that's the table stakes now. I wanted to just shift to a slightly different topic, but it was something that jumped out at me in the report is that one of the respondents said, surprisingly, maybe, I don't know if you would disagree with this, but he says, I don't consider the retention of data something that's actually going to cause litigation, but I do think it's going to make any litigation I have more painful and more expensive because we have bigger volume of data that we're going to have to sift through. So I'd be curious to get your thoughts, John or Imran, on that sentiment, both from the perspective of what is massive data doing to in-house counsel and their jobs, but also this thought that as long as I have controls in place, I don't think that's going to cause litigation. I'm worried about how it impacts my other files.
And to add to that question, the first focus of your question maybe shows us one area in which data and AI can really overlap because one of the ways to manage having a lot of data in a file is to use AI to help you sort through different data.
I'm generally a very positive outlook kind of person, but I don't think anyone or I would say, my house is so secure, nobody can ever break in. Never going to happen.
What did they say about the Titanic, right?
Right. Blanket comments are always dangerous. And I will say, shifting slightly to privacy, but first of all, a cyber attack is going to happen no matter what. If you have a motivated attacker, there's opportunistic attackers, which is the least point of resistance entry that they'll take advantage of. And then you've got motivated attackers. Often we use the term APTs or advanced persistent threats that are out there. They could be government funded. They could be hacktivist group. There are a variety of them that are out there. They say, you are my target. I will find a way in. You need to make one mistake. They'll get into it. And it doesn't matter who you are. What John and I try to work on with our clients and our team is make sure they have a resilience where they can respond quickly. It's the how you're going to be responding to a breach that you're evaluated on. Ted, you go to class actions, you defend clients. It's not the fact that you had a breach that's going to be problematic. It's how you responded to it. Did you act in a methodical, thoughtful way quickly to meet your legal requirements or other requirements that would have been triggered at that point. That's the key. So I think from a purely cyber risk perspective, it's always going to be there. I don't believe that there's no risk that you can, that you can cover and control the data in a manner that'll never be compromised. That's not true. But the second piece of the question is, over collection or data retention. If you look at some of the cases that are out there, Casino-Rama being one that came out, they were praised by the court in terms of how they responded. But when you look at the commissioner's report, there were questions as to why they were retaining certain pieces of information longer than for what it was collected for in the initial case. I think data retention is a key area. We're seeing a lot of it with Law 25 in Quebec that came in, and the future C-27, whenever it comes in, clients are going to be focused much more on reducing their digital footprint.
I know, Imran, I've gotten into some back and forth, some spirited debates with privacy lawyers on your team who want to put in a policy to destroy data, where from my perspective as a litigator, I want to keep relevant data because we might have production obligations down the line, right? So we were balancing those two things.
Well, you just said it. The key word you said in what you just said was relevant data. Yeah. You didn't say all data. And a lot of times clients cannot discriminate. Our tendency, I remember years ago, I worked for this client and it was a fascinating conversation. They're in the not-for-profit space. And they said, look, we're collecting a ton of data. We want to follow the life cycle from when the person starts volunteering with us when they have no money, they're young kids or teenagers, to the time they graduate where they have limited funds or giving us $20 or whatever, to their career pinnacle where they're making the most money. And then when they retire, maybe they want to give us a legacy donation down the road when they pass away. So we want to have the full life cycle of that. Fact of the matter is, you're not collecting that information, disclosing it to the person in the first place. Are you able to do it? Is it appropriate? Just because you can doesn't mean you should. And so those are debates that come up from a privacy law compliance standpoint and what you can do technologically, which is quite significant.
Interesting. John, what do you think about that? The sort of tension between keeping data for AI purposes or for others versus the risk that it carries?
I agree with everything Imran's said, and it has exponentially increased the risks associated with the data breach. So we see that very clearly when we're assisting clients with breaches now. The amount of data involved in breaches compared to today, even 3 or 4 years ago, is exponentially greater. And unfortunately, as Imran indicated, sometimes it's almost like a skeleton in the closet type of data. We see all types of data. They've kept everything. And unfortunately, that is the type of data that has the most exposure and could result in litigation. The old data that should have been purged, former employees or confidential information, that's the most difficult. And we see that in virtually every single breach we deal with now.
It's interesting that this conversation is not at all specifically linked to companies. I'm literally thinking of myself and my photo album on my phone and how I have 57 pictures of my daughter from like the skating rink because she's adorable. And I have to pay for more and more cloud storage because I can't, the manpower to go through and delete those photos.
Well, but that's a great example, Aaron. Anyone who's listening to this podcast right now, and yourselves included, if you want to do a quick test, go into your personal email account, that'd be Gmail, Hotmail, doesn't really matter. The human nature we have is, oh, I may need this some point down the road, I'll keep it. And I have stuff which I'm like, why do I have this from 20 years ago? Do I need it or I don't need it? And often we forget the type of information we're sharing readily by email. It's quite significant. We'll take a picture with our phone and send it to our financial advisor or bank because they need something to validate a KYC thing. Same thing for companies. They collect more than they think they do. John and I, when we're on calls, I kid you not, and we're like, okay, you've had an email breach or other type of breach. What kind of information do you think is in there? Well, not super sensitive, maybe name, address, some telephone numbers in there. We don't collect a lot, just so you know. I said, okay, well, fair enough. That's your initial thought. Here's a document. Why don't you and your team look at it and come back to us if anything seems responsive? And they come back like, oh yeah, Imran, we looked at it. We may have some social insurance numbers and some scans of, passports and driver's licenses. And gosh, now we probably have to do a whole e-discovery. And the problem with that is from a cyber perspective, like going back to what I said earlier, you're judged on how you respond. You're in this conundrum now. Do you respond quickly or do you respond longer? And here's the pro and con. If you respond quickly, you're going to blanket notify everyone. And the larger your footprint, the larger you have to notify a population. Fine, you get speed, but you increase your risk exposure. If you are more surgical, meaning you do a full doc review, that can take weeks if not months in some cases. So now you have a group of people who are going to be very unhappy saying, you had this incident on January 1st, and I'm only hearing about it in March or April, whatever other time frame. So it's really difficult. And it seems cleaning up the house on the data side makes sense, but maybe difficult or time consuming or costly, but the cost down the road can be quite significant, either reputationally or just from a dollars and cents perspective.
Yeah. And those document reviews, like time-sensitive document reviews, it's not like a Google search, typing in important personal information and seeing what gets come up. Like they're painful. It requires man hours. Even with technology-assisted review, you still have to get eyeballs on a lot of those documents in order to train the tools that we have to look for more similar documents. It's a lot of work.
I can understand from this conversation why cybersecurity and AI and data privacy is at the forefront of people's concerns, because there's been so much to unpack on this call in terms of different threads and risks and how they run together. I do want to come back, Imran. You mentioned earlier in our call some legislative updates. So I wanted to make sure we had an opportunity to let you run through any important legislative updates that you think are driving some of this litigation or that are important for people to understand.
I'll kick it off with Law 25 and C-27, which are the two privacy-related developments. And then John can probably touch on C-26, which is on the critical infrastructure side of things for cybersecurity. And then obviously we'll talk about AI afterwards. But look, first time in 20 years, it's an exciting time where entire privacy landscape in Canada is changing materially. So without getting into the specifics of it, in Canada, there's broadly 24 different privacy and data protection laws. So it can be quite difficult to navigate, and rare are the instances where a client is operating in just one jurisdiction. So you can have a situation where multiple pieces of legislation may apply at the same time to the single client with their single breach. So what has happened? If you go back a few years, Quebec adopted something called Bill 64. And that bill turned into Law 25, came into force in three phases, starting in 2022, then 23 and 24 with the three main developments. But the big zoom out picture story with the Law 25 was we have become much more European in our approach. Our prior privacy laws were very much built on an ombudsman model. So this is where you come together, the privacy commissioner, the non-compliant entity, and the complainant, and try to figure out a way to get the compliance. And by and large, it was not an enforcement-driven approach. It was an ombudsman one. And it lacked teeth. You fast forward from that initial 20-year when we adopted this piece of legislation to where GDPR is adopted in Europe, where it's a heavy regulatory hammer. If you're not compliant, there are significant fines, and you'll be investigated, and you better report, so on and so forth. The Europeans had weight, and Canada has something what we call adequacy standard, meaning you can transfer data back and forth Europe and Canada without any limitation. In the classic sense, if you were to send data from Europe to the US, there's all kinds of requirements. You have to enter into agreements and so on. Canada and the Europeans didn't have that previous to GDPR because Canada was deemed to be adequately protecting information of Europeans. So as a country based on commerce, we needed the adequacy standard, which is reviewed every 4 years. GDPR comes in, and then here we're evaluating Canada saying, hold on a second.
Oh, you guys so are we not were going to lose it. We're at risk of losing that.
You may lose adequacy. There could have always been that risk of losing it. So in Quebec, Minister Lebel, at the time who was a Minister of Justice, introduced this Bill 64 or Law 25, which was very much modeled with the European one. Federal government had initially introduced something called C-11, which died on the docket with the previous election, but then got reintroduced as C-27. Which has three parts to it very quickly. One that will essentially replace PIPEDA. Two, and this is the litigation piece angle, a private right of action with a specialized tribunal. So they've moved away from the commissioner issuing fine model that Quebec has adopted, went to a bit more like a tribunal under the Competition Act, for example. So very different model. A lot of questions how you can harmonize that across the country with different regimes. And then thirdly, they introduced this Artificial Intelligence Data Act, one of the first few jurisdictions in the world that has it. So that's currently at second reading. It's making its way through Parliament. There's broad agreement amongst practitioners and others who I've talked to that it's going to be passed in 2024, probably coming into force in 25 or later, but certainly will get passed. So that's one. The other development, and John, you can maybe take this one, is the C-26 one, which is introduced at the same time as C-27, but quite significant from a cybersecurity standpoint.
C-26 is Canada's first real piece of cybersecurity legislation. It is focused at federally regulated critical infrastructure, your banks, airlines, telecoms, other federally regulated industries. It does two things. It amends our existing Telecommunications Act to take account of cybersecurity threats, gives regulators wide scoping power to address cybersecurity threats and risks in the telecommunications sector. But it also enacts what's called the Critical Cyber Systems Protection Act, so the CCSPA, which is a new piece of legislation specifically targeted at federally regulated critical infrastructure. And it has a whole host of requirements, a big one being any entity caught by the scope of this act is required to implement a cybersecurity program within 90 days of enactment, which is very short, must submit that plan to the regulator and any subsequent changes to their plan every year. Significant regulatory oversight of your cybersecurity plan.
And John, that's only if you have an incident. So like you get put on probation, or do all of those federally regulated
entities as it's currently drafted? So very wide-reaching piece of legislation. Even more significant is, as it's currently drafted, there's a requirement for any entity caught by the act to also mitigate their downstream impacts of cyber risks. So to go back to our discussion about third-party vendors, the knock-on effects from this piece of legislation will flow through to the supply chains of all these federally regulated entities. So we expect it to have a very significant impact. There'll be contractual provisions that we also discussed. Those will flow through. There'll be liability flowing through a lot of it, potentially because of this act, Bill C-26. So we expect it to change the cybersecurity landscape in Canada quite significantly.
Well, look, this has been fascinating, if not a little bit doom and gloom. Is there a positive note that we can end this chat on? Is there something you've seen, whether it's in industry, in the report or elsewhere, that gives you a little optimism for how in-house teams can either be more proactive in responding to these risks?
There is a positive tone to this. So we've talked about all the bad things that can happen, but I go back to what I was saying earlier. It's on how you respond that you're going to be judged. And so it may sound obvious, but the more you invest on the front end to prepare and to test, the better the outcome is going to be. It's muscle memory. It's like riding a bike. If you do it every day, you'll know how to ride a bike. But if you've never done it before, even though you have a bike sitting in the garage, you may have struggles riding the bike for the first time. So really here is to have that muscle memory and reaction and remain flexible. Like, there's no perfect answers, right? At the end of the day, you're often faced as an organization with bad and worse options, not good and bad. And making sure that you have canvassed the right decision points and made sure you've identified those issues so that if you do end up in a dispute down the road, litigation, class action, a regulatory investigation, B2B dispute or otherwise, that you can say, look, you know what? There was a logic to what we did. Here's how we proceeded. It was methodical and it was thought through and thoughtful.
From what I'm hearing from this discussion, the other good news for our listeners today and for the general counsel that indicated this as a concern in the survey is that there are people that are thinking about this stuff almost 24/7 and up to date on regulatory changes and what other companies are doing and how to stay ahead of these things and how to deal with them when they happen. And GCs don't have to face these things alone. There's teams like you and John who are there to help if they need.
Yeah, that's great. John, do you want the final word?
I do think the message is positive. To build on your point, Aaron, I think it's a really good one. There's a whole suite of professionals who are ready and willing to assist clients. Client is never alone when handling cybersecurity risk. And it's top of mind, as evidenced by this podcast. So, you know, most organizations are well aware of the risks now. It's just a question of doing it, being proactive and doing it. It's not an unknown risk. So there's a lot of great work being done in terms of preparing for these risks.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Imran.
Hopefully this episode will help people think through some of those risks and how they can stay on top of them and not just make people feel more doom and gloom like Ted was a few minutes ago. But this has been really helpful. You're feeling positive now. Good. Thanks to you both.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was a really interesting discussion, Ted.
Yeah, it was good. It was good. I still can't get my head around the fact that 40% of the organizations that responded to this survey experienced litigation in the cybersecurity data protection and privacy space. Like that's up from 33% in the previous year. That's massive, right?
I don't think it's that surprising based on our conversation though. Based on talking to John and Imran, I mean, there's so much happening. There's regulatory developments. There are, you know, it's evolving so quickly. Hackers are getting more sophisticated. And I think at the same time, people don't quite know what it is because it is evolving so quickly. So there's that sort of fear of the unknown. But I think having fantastic people like John and Imran to call when things come up, I hope will put some of our listeners at ease that, you know, that there's help when these things come up.
Yeah, yeah. It put me more at ease. I still feel like I'm a little uneasy about it. But I like talking with them.
I'm uneasy about being a podcast host now that, you know, John and Imran have told us that people can use our voices. So listeners, please do not use our voices to try to scam Ted and I, please. Yeah.
Don't turn us into deep fakes. I feel like that's what the producers are going to do. And then they can just have AI do episodes instead of us.
Yeah, maybe they won't even need us soon. They'll just be AI hosts. Yeah. All right, listeners. Well, I hope you stick with us or our AI robots that will take over as hosts soon.
Yeah, next episode. All right.
Stay tuned for that.
Thank you for listening to Undisputed, a Disputed spinoff. To learn more and download our 2024 Litigation Trends Survey, visit litigationtrends.com or visit the link in our show notes.
And you can subscribe to Disputed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts currently so that you won't miss any of our episodes.